Phil Picardi here with the NPR News Update. It's Wednesday, August 21st. Minnesota's news on your schedule today features details about a lawsuit against the Vikings Stadium, the state's efforts to prevent companies from patent trolling, Best Buy's improving fortunes, and we hear about the difficulties getting into farming. First, the Minsure Board of Directors takes formal control of the new online health insurance marketplace today. Elizabeth Stawicki reports.
More than 1 million Minnesotans are expected to enroll in health coverage through Minsure, an online site that goes live in a little more than 6 weeks. Legislation that created Minsure last March calls for State Budget Commissioner Jim Showalter to hand over the Minsure reins once the board finalizes a number of tasks. Those tasks include establishing bylaws and policies governing operations, which are expected to be wrapped up at today's board meeting. One of the board's more controversial powers won't take effect until 2015. Then it will decide which insurance plans will be available for sale on the marketplace and which are excluded. This year, any plan that meets federal and state certification requirements will be guaranteed to appear on Minsure. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Mark Dayton is defending a humorous ad campaign for Minnesota's new healthcare exchange that features Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. Some have criticized the ads for making light of the iconic characters. One ad shows a Paul Bunyan statue water skiing and then hitting a tree. But Dayton says the ads have achieved their purpose of attracting attention and getting a buzz going about Minsure.
I hope people pay attention so that we get people on October 1st signing up for the exchange. And you know, given all the pushing on the other side, trying to undermine it and even destroy it, we'll take a good buzz when we get one.
The $9 million marketing campaign is titled Minnesota, Land of 10,000 Reasons to Get Health Insurance. DFL State Auditor Rebecca Otto has announced she will seek a third term next year. Otto also has a Republican challenger as of yesterday. Randy Gilbert is from Wayzata. Here's our Mark Zedeklik with more.
Former Long Lake Mayor Randy Gilbert says he would be a better auditor than Otto. Among other things, Gilbert says he's concerned about state pension liabilities, which he says are underfunded by about 35%.
The path we are on with the unfunded public pension issue leads us straight to Detroit, and I will not allow that to happen.
A Minnesota State Retirement System official said public pensions are funded at more than 80%. State Auditor Otto calls Minnesota a national leader in managing its pension liabilities.
For someone to make a statement that Minnesota is the next Detroit to me is irresponsible and uninformed.
Gilbert says he will abide by the GOP endorsement, meaning he will not run if another candidate wins the backing of the Republican Party. But so far, Gilbert is the only Republican to announce a campaign. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Light rail planners are trying to find common ground with railroad officials over a major sticking point on the Southwest Corridor project. Here's Laura Ewan.
A Metropolitan Council spokeswoman confirms there have been ongoing discussions with the Twin Cities and Western Railroad Company, but she declined to say more. Hennepin County Commissioner Peter McLaughlin says the two parties are trying to find a better way to reroute freight traffic that currently goes through the Woodsy-Kenilworth corridor of Minneapolis. A proposal currently under consideration is drawing fierce objections from residents in St. Louis Park because it places the trains on two-story berms near an elementary school. And an earlier version of the reroute was deemed unsafe by railroad officials because of its steep grades and sharp curves. The president of TCNW says so far, engineers haven't been able to come up with a solution. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis City Council members say they want more information about possible underground tunnels for the Southwest Light Rail line. The Met Council is considering the tunnels to fit the line next to existing freight tracks. The Met Council is also considering rerouting the freight train tracks through St. Louis Park, a plan strongly opposed by a group of St. Louis Park residents. At a council committee meeting yesterday, council member Lisa Goodman told a Met Council staff member she would like an independent assessment of the challenges of tunneling so close to two city lakes.
You're essentially saying we're working to understand it. We think we understand what might happen. And it's not incumbent upon our staff to be doing an independent analysis. Their role is to look out for the interests of the city, not the project.
Met Council officials say they are consulting with construction companies that have done similar projects. Some 600 people gathered in downtown Minneapolis last night to discuss possible solutions for the ongoing Minnesota Orchestra lockout. Participants in the public forum organized by the citizens group Orchestrate Excellence say as audience members they've felt excluded from the 11-month dispute. Group co-chair Lori Greeno says the results of brainstorming sessions will be delivered to the Minnesota Orchestra Board and musicians in coming days.
We're really hopeful that they will take this as a sign or as additional impetus to get to the table and resolve this crisis within the next 2 weeks.
Minnesota Orchestra Music Director Osmo Venska says he will resign if the orchestra has not rehearsed by September the 9th. Audience suggestions for resolving the orchestra's woes range from individuals pledging to raise money for specific sections of the orchestra to demanding state legislators step up to resolve the dispute. Two Twin Cities residents are challenging the state's deal with the Minnesota Vikings to build a new stadium in downtown Minneapolis. Both say the stadium should have been put to a vote by taxpayers before the state committed nearly $500 million for the deal. But with groundbreaking as little as 6 weeks away, the efforts look like long shots. Tim Nelson was in the courtroom for arguments yesterday.
It's been one of the remaining contradictions in the Viking Stadium deal, 16 years after voters in Minneapolis said they wanted a referendum on any new stadium funding. The city is poised to get a second new professional sports facility without a public vote.
This is important to me because I want our public officials to follow the law.
That's Doug Mann, a Minneapolis nurse, Green Party mayoral candidate, and repeated school board challenger. He represented himself before a Hennepin County District Court judge, saying the city should put the stadium issue up for a vote this fall.
I think that a lot of people have been convinced by the propaganda that this has all been a done deal and you can't fight City Hall.
Mann is doing just that and asked the judge for an order to put the stadium deal on the ballot this fall. But City Hall is fighting back. Deputy Minneapolis City Attorney Peter Ginder says state lawmakers gave the Minneapolis City Council the authority to bypass the city charter for the Viking Stadium deal. He says it was written into the stadium legislation and there's no need for a ballot question. Ginder told the judge the state constitution allows so-called special laws, like laws that apply to just one city, to be approved by either voters or by the governing body of a local unit of government. The Minneapolis City Council voted 7-6 in May 2012 to approve a plan to contribute $150 million for the stadium construction. After the hearing, Ginder offered a third argument, saying that because state-authorized hospitality taxes will fund the deal, it isn't legally city money.
Even without the override, this would not have triggered a referendum requirement because of the definition in the statutes about what is a local resource. It would not have been a resource under the city charter, and it would not have triggered a referendum requirement either.
The judge noted that the stadium plan, signed into law by Governor Mark Dayton, expressly exempted the city from a referendum on the deal. Mann, the mayoral candidate who brought the legal challenge, also conceded in court that the legislature has the authority to repeal laws, including a city charter provision. That could make it tough to win his case. Mann's challenge is also facing a fast-approaching deadline. The city's general election is just 77 days away. County elections manager Ginny Gelms says any referendum language has to be finalized and submitted by this Friday to qualify for the November 5th ballot. It's unlikely Mann's case will be decided by then. The judge left the case open through Monday for more written arguments. Again, city attorney Peter Ginder.
It's really difficult, if not impossible, to place this on the general election this fall.
And there's yet another deadline looming. The state may sell stadium bonds and break ground on the new facility yet this fall. That would make the stadium deal financially difficult to unwind. And there's another legal challenge waiting. A man from Blaine has filed suit against the state. Paul Johnson also says voters in Minneapolis should weigh in. He lives near another site in Arden Hills that was considered for the stadium. Johnson says the state shouldn't have nixed a 2011 deal between the Vikings and Ramsey County for that site because officials feared they'd lose a ballot question on sales taxes in the deal. Johnson says the two cases create a double standard for stadium referendums that isn't fair.
Wave it for Arden Hills like you did in Minneapolis. And if you don't want to waive it for Ramsey County, then don't waive it for Minneapolis.
Paul Johnson says he'll make his case in a St. Paul courtroom on September 19th.
Tim Nelson in Minneapolis, and on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. A Delaware-based company that's been threatening Minnesota businesses with lawsuits over patent infringements has agreed to scale back its campaign. Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson announced a settlement yesterday with MPHJ Technology. Swanson says the company and its affiliates gin up claims of patent infringement without any evidence. Here's Annie Baxter with more.
Earlier this year, Joanne Sprino got a letter that she found confusing. It was threatening her with a lawsuit over an alleged patent violation. Sprino co-owns a couple movie theaters in Cambridge and North Branch, and she says she didn't really understand what she could have done wrong.
It was in regards to some scanner, that's all I know. But I don't even own that product.
Sprino ignored the first letter, but then more letters poured in, each one more threatening. One provided a court date for the potential lawsuit against her. Sprino says she tried to reach the Texas attorney who was listed on the letters, but no one would take her call.
They wouldn't even get on the phone and tell me what it was. It was just, you're getting sued. I didn't even know what I was being sued for.
It turns out MPHJ Technology Investments LLC was accusing Sprino and other business owners in Minnesota of using basic office equipment to scan and then email documents in violation of its patents. To stave off a lawsuit, MPHJ was demanding payment of licensing fees of about $1,000 for every employee at the companies it targeted.
We think they just, without evidence or much basis in fact, cast a wide net and send out these letters on kind of a fishing expedition. And of course, if people pay money where they don't owe the money, you can make a lot of money.
That's Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson. Experts say it's possible that some of the companies MPHJ targeted had in fact violated the company's patents. But Swanson says MPHJ didn't explain to business owners how it concluded they were even using scanners.
You're suggesting to that person, hey, I have the goods on you. You owe me money. Basically, if that violates, you know, consumer protection laws.
MPHJ told Swanson it never actually succeeded in collecting any money from individuals in Minnesota. If it did, the company could be on the hook for a $50,000 civil penalty. Brian Farney, an attorney for MPHJ, declined an interview. In an emailed statement, he noted that the company's settlement with Swanson doesn't allege any wrongdoing. MPHJ is also facing scrutiny from the attorneys general of Vermont and Nebraska. Farney says, quote, none of the company's actions in Minnesota or elsewhere were wrongful or unlawful.
Patent law gives you the right to prevent anyone from making, using, or selling your invention.
Mark Lemley is a law professor at Stanford University who specializes in intellectual property issues. He says companies like MPHJ often get called patent trolls. They're firms that own patents and don't actually produce anything. They make money by going after potential violators of their patents. But that is legal. Lemley says over the past couple years, patent trolls have pursued not just manufacturers who might violate a patent, but increasingly the end users, consumers who use the patented products or processes.
If your scanner might infringe a patent, well, you could imagine the same thing happening with your car, with your computer, and your cell phone.
Lemley says proposals in Congress may help reform the patent system. Meanwhile, a handful of big manufacturers, including Xerox and Hewlett-Packard, are asking the U.S. Patent and Trade Office to take a look at MPHJ's patents and consider whether they should be invalidated. Here in Minnesota, MPHJ can still pursue companies for violation of its patents, but it must first seek approval from the state's attorney general, which means no more so-called fishing expeditions.
Business reporter Annie Baxter. Shares of Best Buy soared 13% yesterday after a strong earnings report. The Richfield-based retailer's bottom line improved, even though the company cut prices to compete with rivals like Walmart and Amazon.com. Martin Moylan reported last night for All Things Considered.
the retailer's shares closed at $34.80. That's more than triple the price where the swooning stock hit bottom in the days after Christmas. Best Buy earned $266 million, more than 20 times the bottom line in the same quarter a year ago. At the same time, revenue fell slightly, but what really pleased Wall Street was the retailer showed it could trim prices without gutting profits. In an interview after the earnings report, CEO Hubert Joly said the company is determined not to lose customers because its prices are too high.
Our goal is not to be 10% cheaper than the other guys because, in fact, we offer a superior customer experience, but we don't want price to be an obstacle. And so that's how we've introduced the price matching policy a few months ago, so we won't be beat.
Best Buy has also been cutting prices throughout its stores, though it won't quantify how much. The company says its sticker prices are steadily getting closer to rivals who have offered lower prices. Last November, only 4% of Wall Street analysts following the stock had a buy rating, as many questioned the company's survival. Now the number of buy ratings is nearly half, according to information compiled by Bloomberg. Joly has a ready quip for the doubters.
People who thought we were dead wrong.
And Joly says the company has a formula that's sustainable over the long term, even against adversaries like Walmart and Amazon.
Broad assortments, advice, convenience, service at very competitive prices.
To help offset price reductions, Best Buy has been cutting costs by hundreds of millions of dollars. Those cuts have included several hundred job cuts at the company's Richfield headquarters. The retailer also has been closing underperforming stores and revamping others, providing more in-store sales space for key vendors such as Samsung and Microsoft. Best Buy has been upgrading its website, too, improving search capabilities and working to provide more customer reviews of products and fill orders more quickly by shipping products from stores as well as warehouses. Online sales rose 11%. Sales at stores open at least 14 months slipped slightly, but that was an improvement over recent declines of as much as 5%. Edward Jones retail analyst Brian Yarbrough says declines in comparable store sales aren't good enough for the long term.
In the next year, they're going to have to start showing better comps, but they've definitely stopped the bleeding they had seen.
This past winter's doubts about the company's future grew in the wake of a leadership scandal and as founder Dick Schultz struggled to find financial partners to help him buy the company and take it private. Schultz failed to make a bid but made peace with the company. Morningstar retail analyst R.J. Hottovy says Joly greatly aided the company by stabilizing its business and getting Schultz, the company's biggest shareholder, to back his strategy and vision for Best Buy.
That's why the market has been willing to give management the benefit of the doubt right now in terms of their turnaround plan, with that soap opera being something in the past now.
Hottovy says Best Buy seems to be finding the right balance of keeping prices low enough and still making a profit.
It seems like it can reduce prices to remain competitive with players like Amazon, Walmart, Costco, and still generate some profitability out of it.
Hottovy says Best Buy has a profitable future, but he doubts it'll be as profitable as Joly envisions. Hottovy expects the retailer's rivals will see to that by responding with price cuts of their own.
Martin Moylan on the NPR News Update. Closing out the podcast, a look at the changing family farm. NPR has been running a series of reports on the difficulties young people are having getting into ranching and farming. And here in Minnesota, there are several groups trying to bridge the generation gap in farming. They have launched a new website, farmtransitions.org. It's meant to be a one-stop shop for helping older farmers transition their land to a new generation. Kathy Werzer talked with Jan Joannidis, Executive Director of Renewing the Countryside, which helped create the new website.
Here in Minnesota, what are the barriers to getting young folks into farming?
Well, I think that there are a number of barriers. There are certainly people out there who want to farm. Some of them have come from farms and want to get back into it. And there's a surprisingly large number of young people who didn't come from farming families, or at least their parents didn't farm, who are looking to get into farming. And the barriers that that group in particular faces really is access to land and access to capital. As you know, land prices have skyrocketed in the last couple of years, and farmland in particular isn't easy to come by.
Now, if an older person needs to sell the farm, aren't investors then in large ag companies the only option? Because a young farmer, as you just spelled out, has little money to deal with these high land prices. It's really tough to get land.
I think that's sort of the narrative that's out there. And there are certainly companies out there who are looking for land for investors because land is a good place to invest. But what we're seeing is that there are farmers out there who have land who have actually ended up with a lot larger net wealth at this point because the prices of their land have gone up. And there's definitely interest in finding other options besides just selling their whole farm to the highest bidder.
What are those options, though?
Well, you know, we have had people contact us who say, you know, we'd love to help a new farmer get into farming and maybe doing some sort of apprenticeship option over time and basically having the farmer work off some of the costs or to even come in at a lower price for a farmer if they can help them get it started. So for some of the current farmers, getting full price isn't important, and they would rather see young farmers on the land. There are also some really great programs out there. The Farm Service Agency has really kind of changed some of the way they work with new farmers to make it easier for them to get loans. AgStar is another banking and ag lender who's really doing some innovative things in terms of trying to make it possible to get young people on the land. And then we have this idea that we've been working on of having a Grow a Farmer investment fund where people could actually invest in young farmers and try and get them off land because we all want to have good food in the future. So it's an important investment, I think.
Are you also running into the problem where you have an older farmer who wants to get out of the day-to-day work but wants to stay in his house, or her house for that matter? How does that work in rural Minnesota where you may have a young farm family wanting to farm, but you've got this issue of the older farmer saying, I don't want to move out of my house?
I think that that is one of the biggest tangles we need to figure out right now because having moved to a rural property myself recently, I can see how you can quickly get attached, and if you've lived there all your life, to just, you know, get up and move to the city or the small town is really leaving kind of, you know, kind of your heart and soul behind. And one of the issues that we've seen that is in a lot of counties, the zoning is such that there can only be one house on the land. So we're actually doing some research with the University of Minnesota this fall to look if there are innovative solutions to that. Because, you know, ideally, if you could get a young farm family living on the land with the aging farmer, not only does that, you know, is there a knowledge transfer there, but as farmers are getting older, they're also going to probably need some additional care. So you could, I think it might be a real creative solution to the fact that in rural areas, care for elderly is also something that's declining.
So it's kind of like going back to the old days in a sense.
It is, and it just might be, it might not be that it's your mom and dad that you're staying with. It might be new farmers connecting with older farmers. I think that's the other thing that we're seeing is that a lot of the older farmers, because there was a time, and some would still say this, that you don't want to get into farming because it's hard work and, you know, you never know what the weather is and it's a risky business. And so they really encouraged their kids to go off to college and you know, get professional careers. And so there are a lot of those aging farmers whose kids are, you know, successful professionals now and don't want to come back to the farm.
Jan, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
Jan Joannidis of Renewing the Countryside and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition and on the NPR News Update. Thanks for listening to the Wednesday edition. Come back tomorrow for Thursday's Minnesota News on your schedule.